Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
Now, after 6 years and two not particularly successful albums, Bobby Gillespie and his band Primal Scream finally hit the bullseye with Screamadelica, the psychedelic double album masterpiece that ushered in the 1990s. Well, this week sees the release of his autobiography, Tenement Kid, and it's Bobby Gillespie's story up to the recording and release of that album. It's a memoir that cuts a righteous path through a decade lost to Thatcherism and saved by Acid House. Or something like that, anyway. So, Bobby, welcome to the programme. First of all, the name of the book, Tenement Kid, is that because the first 10 years of your life, basically, they never really leave you?
Yeah. I mean, they're foundational years in my development as a human being, you know?
But, I mean, like, the thing about it is that, like, you know, they were very difficult times. My God almighty. You know, like, for instance, like, a family living in one room. And when I say you shared a bathroom, like, for instance, you shared a bathroom with a bunch of other families on the same floor kind of thing, you know?
Well, we never, well, when it was a bathroom. Yeah, it was basically a toilet seat, you know? For the first, like, 3 years of my life, I lived in a single room with my mum and dad, and we had the outside toilet shared with two other families on the landing. But then we moved downstairs when my brother came along when I was three, and we had a room and a kitchen. It was it's called a room and kitchen in Glasgow parlance. So my brother, my mum, my dad and me shared a room until I was 11, bedroom. And we had a small hallway that linked to the kitchen, a kitchenette. And there was a small library in the hall, you know, that my dads had put together. And that's where I grew up, you know.
Okay, but the thing about it is like, you think school might give some sort of respite. At least you were all together at school. But no, I mean, at school, you were basically put into what you would call a remedial class. But more importantly, do you think the whole educational structures were set up to define somebody like you, Bobby Gillespie, as, well, this guy's stupid? And I use the word stupid.
No, it was done by class, I think. I think really the whole, it was a comprehensive, they called it a comprehensive school, the school that I went to, the secondary school. When you were 11, if you passed the 11 plus exam, you could go to grammar school. I never passed the 11 plus exam. I didn't know what studying was, neither did my parents. You know, you were just told, you know, in a couple of weeks there's going to be this exam, and everybody knew when you were like 11.
Yeah,
you knew that if you passed that exam, you went to a smarter school, and if you didn't, you were at a less smart school. You know, so if you failed, like I failed, you felt like a failure, you know, at that age. You kind of felt, well, that's it. I'm not going to go to university. I'm obviously not bright enough. And a bit of shame involved, more than a bit of shame. But I went to the local comprehensive, Kings Park Secondary. And again, there was like 40 kids in each class. And each lesson lasted an hour. And even, you know, we had some teachers that weren't so, they were quite cruel. And we had other teachers that were cool, you know, cool and cruel. And even in the cool classes, you know, with the kind of liberal-minded teachers, they had an hour to try and teach 40 kids. You know, I think if you weren't a quick learner, you know, you would get left behind. And the classes were graded in A, B, C, D, E, maybe, you know. And so I was in the A class for history, but I was in like the C class for English and art. You know, my wife thinks I'm on some kind of like spectrum or whatever, but you know, so there were some things I just took naturally to, which were English, art and history, and other things I just were like a blockage, like arithmetic, mathematics and woodworking stuff, you know.
Well, you did become a apprentice apprentice, and then you left school at 16 before that, and then later on, really, your real education on so many different levels, basically, in a word, was punk. I mean, not just the whole thing of it, not just the camaraderie, not just the brotherhood of it all. And everybody really was very nice looking after each other. You make that point very much so in the book throughout in terms of all the bands. But even stuff like a band like the Daruti Column or words like the Situationists and all this, because it sprung from something that you loved, you learned an awful lot about things that would never have meant anything to you as you gazed out the window in a school.
Well, you know, the thing about the Durrutti Column have taken the name from Juan Aventura Durrutti, who was a Spanish anarchist who had led the, you know, the Durrutti Column was his brigade, his socialist brigade. And they fought, you know, they won every battle against Franco's fascists. Again, that obviously came from Tony Wilson's interest in the Spanish Civil War, but also I think he got it from a Malcolm McLaren t-shirt. One day you're going to wake up and find yourself on one side of the bed. And, you know, Buenaventura Durruti and his column was one of the names of the when the good stuff that Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood, you know, like... were approval, you know, approving of, you know, as was of Guy Debord and people like Kenneth Anger, the filmmaker. So, you know, but also that tied in at the fact that my dad was very interested in the Spanish Civil War, and my dad and other trade unionists in Glasgow helped erect a statue of La Pasionara, who was the heroine of the Spanish Civil War of the Republican side, and which is still there to this day, and it stands in the Clydeside in Glasgow. Yeah. It's directly across the road from the Communist Club on the Clyde.
And your
walkway,
father,
you know,
Bobby, your father was a trade union activist in that, and the miners' strike at the age of 13. You sort of soaked up all of this in your early teens. But just one thing, like in terms of a crowd going to Parkhead and seeing Celtic and, you know, Charlie George or Rodney Marsh or Stan Bowles or George Best and the players at the time, did they have a big effect on you? Or were you just amazed at what can actually happen on the terraces of Parkhead during, say, a Celtic Rangers match or something?
Well, I was a Celtic fan. Well, I'm a Celtic fan, right, obviously. But when I was 11, I moved to a place called Mount Florida, and I was two streets away from Hampden Park. So on big match days, like semi-finals or cup finals or home internationals, you know, the streets in my area would be packed with football fans. And I had a big interest in football, you know, at the age of 11, you know, I was a Celtic fan from the mid-60s onwards, late-60s onwards. And, you know, in the last 20 minutes, they would open the doors and us local kids could get into the match for free.
Yeah.
And I would just soak up the atmosphere, you know. The energy would be incredible and electric and vibrant and seductive. And it was just, obviously, it was just so exciting to like a little kid,
okay,
you know, 11-year-old kid, you know.
Okay,
what are you asking?
No, I'll tell you what I'm asking. Take that energy at the age of 11, 12 or 13, or what happens to be, and move it on to the Apollo in Glasgow, where Thin Lizzy are playing. And just the effect that Thin Lizzy had. Is there something to do with Philo's guitar and the way the lights used to shine off the silver bit?
Well, that was my very Thin Lizzy October, Glasgow Apollo October. I don't know when it was, but it was 1976. So it was a Johnny the Fox tour. And I went to the gig with Alan McGee, and I was like 15 or whatever, maybe 14, I can't remember. But we were... the gig was so incredibly exciting. Never seen a rock band live before. This was Thin Lizzy in their prime. Brian Downey, Dublin's on Brian Downey on drums. Glasgow's Brian Robertson on guitar. Scott Gorham, who was Californian. And, of course, Phil Lynott, Dublin's own son, Phil Lynott, on guitar, bass, and songwriting and vocal duties. And it was just the most incredible... in the book, I say I lost my rock and roll virginity to Phil Lynott and Thin Lizzy. Yeah. What a way
you also
to do
say
it,
you also say you were filled with the Holy Spirit of rock and roll.
That's right, Phil filled me. I was an empty vessel, and Phil filled me with. I became a believer that night, you know, and I'm still a believer. And but yeah, it was so exciting, you know. And Phil had this mirrored scratch plate, and there was a spotlight every time he moved the bass. There was a reflection from the spotlight, and it would get into the crowd. And a few times during the night, it hit me. And I don't think I said to Alan McGee at the time, but inwardly, I was saying to myself, "Yeah, he knew I was out there. You know, that was meant to be. You know,
yeah,
it was
right.
Like Phil was past. You know, he was. I was one of the chosen ones. You know,
yeah, of course you were. Do you know something?
Of course I was.
You know, later on, you were one of the chosen ones in some ways, in terms of just the effect that the specials had on you. I mean, firstly, like Jerry Dammers goes, yeah, here, do you want to join us for a meal? First time you were ever in a restaurant, most likely. And Jerry Dammers comes, and like the energy of the specials on stage, that was a real powerful thing for you, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I saw them open for the Clash in 1978. The gig was Glasgow Apollo. It was July, I think, 78. And it was a Clash, Suicide and the Specials on the same bill. And but the Specials were pretty much a different band then. They didn't have the 60s tonic suits and the pork pie hats. They were a bit pub rock looking, I guess, you know. Lots of old guys in the band and stuff. And For some reason in my mind, I think Terry Hall was dressed like a Hare Krishna. But I remember him sitting on the edge of the stage. But fast forward 2 years, a year later, 79, they're, you know, just as Gangsters has been released and John Peel's playing it, a bunch of us drive through from Glasgow to Edinburgh to see specials. And this is when they got the kind of mod image or the rude boy image with the 60s tonic suits and the pork pie hats. And, you know, and they were just beginning to explode. And we met Jerry Darmers on the street and he took us for a meal. It was a lovely bloke, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, by the way, let's take some music. Here's music from Primal Scream. There you go. That's music from Primal Scream. And we're talking here to Bobby Gillespie, Tenement Kid he is. Tenement Kid is his story, the full story of him with all the music and all. By the way, one thing I didn't know, were you a roadie as such with Altered Images?
Well, the story is that they were friends of mine, that they were at school and I'd just left school and I'd kind of seen them around town in the record shops on a Saturday afternoon and, you know, down at the Paddy's Market buying secondhand clothes, looking for old men's D-mob suits to wear and stuff, you know. And so we just got chatting one day and at the bus stop, 31 bus stop in St. Enoch Square. And I said, what do you do and stuff? And he said, we're at school, but we would get a band. We're putting a band together. Do you want to come and see us rehearse? So I began going to the rehearsals and hanging out with them and just listening to records up in their houses and stuff. And when they played their first gig at the Mars Bar in Glasgow, I helped them unload the gear and helped them reload the gear. And I made the posters. I designed the posters for the early gigs. And I made stencils to spray paint Altered Images on the amplifiers and on the guitar cases. So I was just kind of hanging out with the band. And so that's why I write in the book, I kind of roaded for them because it was just... You know, everybody roadies, you know, I just helped her. You know, the band didn't have any roadies, you know.
And you mentioned Spike Island, one of the most famous gigs ever in Britain with the Stone Roses. And who was roadieing there, of course? Noel Gallagher with In Spiral Carpets, who looked like Joey Ramone, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think he said that I look like Joey Ramone.
Sorry, you know? That was it, that you looked like Joey Ramone. I want to jump forward to something else here. We're talking to Bobby Gillespie here. And just take a listen to this here.
Just what is it that you want to do?
There you go. You all know what that is. That's music there. Loaded, the little piece at the beginning in particular as well. With Loaded and Andrew Weatherall and everything else that happened, the whole new kind of, you represented a new psychedelic vanguard. Do you find that you have an awful lot to thank Andrew Weatherall for? One of the main reasons being that he opened you up to a very different way of making music and the result was Screamadelica.
Well, I think the answer to that is quite simple. I think the team of Andrew Weatherall and Primal Scream were mutually beneficial to each other.
Yeah.
You know, I think one couldn't have happened without the other. And I think that, you know, Weatherall, in the book, I say he was like a Jimmy Miller, George Martin, kind of Lee Perry, kind of style producer that did more than just balance the sound, you know. Weatherall was a co-conspirator, you know, in the making of Screamadelica. It was just that was the spirit of the times, you know. We were a band that was brave enough to work with a guy who hadn't had any studio experience in making pop records, you know.
Yeah.
We approached our work with Weatherall on a purely experimental basis, you know. And we released the results of that and people just loved it, you know. It was no other rock band was doing it. It was almost like he was creating dub versions of our songs, you know.
Yeah, right.
It was like a dub album in some ways, Screamadelica, you know. It's a dub album and yeah, it was just a great time, you know.
And did you like what it did to you, Bobby? And what I mean by that was you became bona fide pop stars. Did you like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I loved that. Yeah.
And even like Top of the Pops, I mean, like you mentioned Top of the Pops a lot, because that was like where everything happened on a Thursday night. Mata Hoople and Sparks and Alice and Susie and Bowie and T-Rex. And obviously the Sweet, your first single you ever bought was Hellraiser. But like you were on Top of the Pops as well and all that kind of thing. Was it like, okay, we've arrived, let's go on tour. So you go, you'd been to Flanders with the only time with a school tour once. And the first time you really go away was Germany. What, like in terms of the band, was it good? Was it good fun?
Well, the first time I was abroad really, on my own terms, was with the Jesus Mary Chain in Germany in 1984, but that's before the Mary Chain had even released a single. So no one knew us, you know, but it was a great adventure. You know, I just, all I wanted to do was go and tour. You know, we're a rock and roll band that I was a member of, and you know, we did that, and it was a great experience. You know, I'll never forget it. We had a real camaraderie and brotherhood in the Mary Chain, you know, and it still stays with me today. And I write lovingly in the book about my relationship with the Reeds and Douglas Heart, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, you do. And also, like, just the random things that happen, Bobby, just one or two last bits here. You're in Abbey Road. Robert Fripp is in the studio next door. You're making a pick. Get him in to do a bit of guitar. It's like, it's brilliant, the way those things happen.
Oh, well, this is the thing, you know. I think if you're open to experience, then any great things can happen, you know. If you're closed-minded, they're not going to happen. Just like the way we work with Weatherall, we were completely open-minded because of our musical background and the things that we loved, with dub reggae, you know, like Lee Perry or Joe Gibbs, you know, Thomson Productions and Jamaica and stuff. Or, you know, we were, our can, you know, we were open to working with somebody like Weatherall. Whereas with the Robert Fripp thing, we weren't exactly fans of King Crimson, but we loved what Fripp did on the Heroes, Bowie's Heroes. And it was actually, the idea was Clive Langer, our producer on the song Imperial. Clive said, "Hey, Fripp's next door. Should we ask him?" Let's ask him. You know, and Fripp came in, and he ran through the song two or three times, and he was fabulous. You know, a real gentleman.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then, just two last ones. The first one is this: that you know, the Sex Pistols, like, you really go on about punk and just how important it was as a cultural thing and everything else, and how it saved your life almost. But like, immediately after the Sex Pistols, very quickly, when people thought the Sex Pistols were still alive, came Public Image Limited. And it was a totally different and absolutely different thing. Like Johnny Rotten, or sorry, not even Johnny Rotten, John Lydon, if you like. "You never listen to a word I said. You only see me for the clothes that I wear." But did you take that in and go, "Oh, wow, okay, we can go somewhere different. I like this. This is not punk, whatever it is, it's great."
Yeah, that was, for me, that reinvention, that particular reinvention of John Lydon from the Sex Pistols, high energy rock and roll, to the art rock of Pill, the poetic art rock of Pill, was a signifier of the way things could be done creatively, you know.
One other last thing, obviously, there's an awful lot of drugs in the book, Bobby, a heck of a lot of drugs. That's just what it was. Do you ever think maybe you took too many?
No, because I'm still here making good records, and I've just written a good book, you know. That was the culture, that was the rock and roll culture, and that was the acid house culture. Without ecstasy, there would be no acid house. Without ecstasy, there would be no Screamadelica. That's a fact.
Okay, well, listen, Bobby, congratulations, and thank you so much indeed, and well done on the book. And one last thing is, I can't believe you haven't followed the career of Margot Random and the Space Virgins, for God's sake.
I know, I know. That's...
And you've never heard the full 12-inch version of South of the River Thames by her. Fantastic.
Have you got it?
No, I don't. I heard it from John Peel, that's all. No, I don't.
All right. Is it any good?
Listen, what I heard it was, it's a bit of a laugh, like a million things around that time, 1981 or whatever it was.
Yeah,
listen,
John Peel, he liked that kind of stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Bobby, listen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. Good man yourself.
Thanks,
congratulations.
Dave. Thanks.
Well done.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.